So today we shall start this beautiful text. As I had said last time, so far the last few years we had been talking about the path of knowledge, the path of the intellect, of the brain, the path of knowledge. Today onwards, the text that we shall start will talk about the path of love, the path of the mind, the path of the heart. As we said, they are both equally important. One has to know, who am I, who is God, what is the world, and what is my relationship with the world and with God. But I also need to know how through love I can reach. And when they are both working together, love is a very powerful force, because when you love something, then you will do anything to acquire it, to possess it, to want it, to become one with it. It could be a beloved, it could be a powerful post, you know, somebody wants to be the president or somebody wants to win the Olympics. But when he has love for that goal, then the progress is faster. So the next few months, we'll talk about devotion or bhakti, which is the path of love, and love not in the ordinary sense of where we love somebody, but how we can transfer this love to God. So in this book, these are the five questions that we shall seek to answer. I won't answer them today, but I'll just put them out there so that we know that this is what we shall be covering in the next few months. And number one is, what is the nature of devotion? What is devotion? And what is the altar of devotion? To whom is this devotion expressed? So that is question number one. And then second is, how does this devotion express? How does it manifest in the world? How do we know that this devotion is coming in me? So how can I tell that? The third question is, how to cultivate? And that is the most important question, because at this moment, we have love for God, but it is not a total, unconditional, total surrender. It is still a very partial, very conditioned love. So how can I cultivate this unconditional, total love? And then there will be obstacles on the path as I am trying to develop this devotion. So we shall learn how to overcome the obstacles. And then when I see a true devotee of the Lord, how do I recognize him? Does he have a light around his head, or does he walk on water, or what does he do, or she? So how do we develop this devotion, and how do we recognize a true devotee? So these are the five questions. So today I shall read the two verses, the introduction and verse number one, translate them, and talk a little bit about these two verses. So first is on page number one, which is a part of the introduction, which we didn't cover last week. Varsha Ritu Raghupati Bhagati. Tu Raghupati Bhagati. Tulsi Sali Sudas. Ram Naam Bar Baran Dou. बर बरन दो सावन भादो मास. So here he is comparing our heart to the earth and the Lord's name as rain. So he says Raghupati. Raghupati is Lord Ram. God, we believe that God incarnated as Ram, and I'll talk a little bit about it. When we talk about who was this Rama, who was this God Rama, why did he incarnate? So he says the name of God is like the rain, Varsha Ritu. And what is the result of that? He says are the devotees, are the crops. When the Lord's name falls in our heart, we become devotees. And what is the Ram? Ram has two syllables, Ra, Ma. So Ram, the name of Ram is like the 2 months. Because in India, the monsoon season lasts for actually July and August are the main months, and then half of June and half of September. So most of the rain falls in July and August. So the The name of God is like the July and August where it rains. So before we proceed with the actual verse, I just wanted to talk a little bit about who Ram is, because this book is dedicated to Ram. And Ram we consider as one of the incarnations of the Supreme Divine Consciousness that we call Brahman or the Lord, Father in Heaven, appeared on earth as Ram, just as Christians revere Christ, that he is an incarnation of the Lord and he's the Son of God. So Ram, we worship and adore, and of course Krishna, these are the two human manifestations. Of course, there are many divine powers in heaven like Shiva and Ganpati and Brahmaji and all. But when the Supreme decided to appear on earth as human, these are the two forms he took, Ram and then Krishna. So who is Lord Ram? Why do we worship him? So they say that Ram appeared on earth a few thousand years ago, 6,000-7,000 years ago. And the main reason for his incarnation was to show us how an ideal human being should live. Even though he had all the divine powers, he never manifested a single, did not perform a single miracle, did not show a single divine. Unlike Lord Krishna, he did show some places, you know, flashes of his divinity. But Lord Ram said, I'm here to show how an ideal human being should live. And his life is a perfect example of how anybody should live their life. He was an ideal son to his parents. He did everything and anything, and he sacrificed his whole life for his parents. He was an ideal husband to his wife. In fact, one of the reasons he incarnated was there was a very evil demon called Ravana, who actually was so powerful, he not only had overcome the earth, but had even captured the heavens and the lower worlds. He had that much power he could. And so he needed to be removed because he was very evil, very arrogant, very wicked. And so Ram appeared on earth to remove this evil demon, but did not show any of his divine powers. He said, as a human, I'm going to defeat him. So this evil king, even when he kidnapped Ram's wife, that's how this whole story, in the middle of the story, then Ram goes and saves his wife, and in the process, he overcomes this evil demon. But not only was he an ideal son, an ideal husband, but he was even an ideal enemy. He even at the last minute, he tells the evil demon, he says, I have no hatred towards you. You just give me my wife back and I'll spare you. Even though he had kept her prisoner for so long. So even at that moment, he had no malice, no hatred towards him. And of course, the demon said, I'm not going to give her. I have her in my control. And then at the end, of course, the war happened and he had to be killed. So he was an ideal enemy because he had no hatred for anybody. He was an ideal friend. Anybody who approached him with friendship, he did everything he could to help him. He was an ideal king. Later on, when his father passed away, he becomes the king. And the way he runs the country is a true example of how a ruler should be, how he should respond to his subjects, how he should take care of all their needs and always be concerned about the welfare. So, of course, his life is very extensive. It is several thousand verses. We can't go into the details, but I just wanted to kind of introduce people as to who God Ram is. And his life, we find throughout, is a life of sacrifice. And if you see the total divinity, the Lord, Father in heaven, he is constantly sacrificing for us. He's constantly giving us whatever he has, you know, the rain, the sun, the beautiful earth, all the minerals that we get from it, our breath, our life. So constantly, and we find that in all the religions. If you look at the life of Christ, you know, it was a life of sacrifice where he gave the supreme sacrifice for all of us. If we look at the life of the Sikh gurus, of the Hindu saints, how they sacrifice their life and their well-being to preserve the sanctity of the religion, to protect the religion. You look at Mirabai, look at Tukaram, Sant Gyaneshwar, Guru Gobind Singh, all the great saints of India, they all gave up everything they had to protect. And we accept the sacrifice. Okay, you know, Jesus sacrificed for my sins. That's wonderful. And then we end it right there. But if I'm a true Christian, what do I do with that sacrifice? Do I say, okay, Jesus sacrificed, I'm fine, or let me move on? No. If I'm an ideal Christian, I have to then in turn transfer that sacrifice to the world. I have to sacrifice my well-being. I have to help others. It doesn't mean you necessarily have to give up your life, but how can I help others? How can I give others? How can I share with others whatever I have? Then only I can be called a true Christian, a true Sikh, a true Hindu, a true Muslim. When I can share my love, I can share my time, I can share my possessions, I can share my labor. So whatever abilities I have, when they are used in the service of the Lord, because the Lord who has given me so much and constantly sacrifices. In fact, in the Gita it says that this universe emerged out of sacrifice. In the fourth chapter, it says it very beautifully, that as a result of the sacrifice, this whole universe was created. So the idea being that I should, and the biggest sacrifice I make is of my ego. Because the ego is the main obstacle in our spiritual journey, where I and my, and I know where I am the doer, I did so much, I am so great, I am so wonderful. When that ego can be sacrificed at the altar of the Lord, it does not mean that you become a useless or a humble or a worthless person, but give up this notion of doership and that the Lord is working through me, He's doing whatever is happening at this moment, then not only your actions become pure as you remember the Lord, but you get a lot more power. Your words have more conviction. They touch people. Your actions are more powerful. So that is what the Lord represents for us, sacrifice. Then it says, Rama Naam Bara Baranado. So the chanting the name of God has a lot of benefit. And one should constantly remember, it doesn't, whatever name and form, whether you pick Ram or you pick Jesus or you pick the Mother Goddess or you pick the Guru, it doesn't matter. But pick one name of the Lord and chant that constantly in your mind with love. And here they have given a very beautiful example, very beautiful simile, because in India it gets very hot. The month of May is so hot. It's 110, 115 degrees. The earth is baking. It's so dry. And it's just parched and it is just waiting. And then in June, little bit the rain starts. But then in July and August, the torrential monsoons, it rains so much that sometimes you get 12, 15 inches of rain a day. You know, heavy rain, it just floods the whole. And in some areas, they have, you know, up to 300, 400 inches of rain a year in some parts of India. But in the northern part where it is very hot, there is rain, but it is only for 2 months. But it is so heavy that the earth is satisfied. You know, she's the Mother Earth is dry and she's thirsty. And then the rain falls and she's so happy, you know. And then the grass starts growing and the flowers start coming out and the trees start blooming, the crops start growing, you know, the wheat and the rice. And the animals are happy because they have water to drink and, you know, they can enjoy the rain falling. As the crops are doing well, the agriculture does well, then the whole economy improves because India, at least in those days, was an agricultural economy. So if the farmers have money, they can go out and buy goods and so the business prospers. So the whole country, the whole earth feels happy when it rains. So similarly, our heart, which is dry, which is filled with lot of negativity, you know, a lot of dryness, you know, like we feel cold towards others. I don't care for others. I'm so arrogant and so angry and so suspicious and so distant. And, you know, from the modern society conditions us. You don't need to know what is your neighbor doing. Not that out of nosiness, but out of concern. You know, if something is happening in my neighbor's house or something, but we are trained, and then now with all this TV, oh, don't let your children go outside, don't let them play. So we have become such a fearful society, and our hearts are so closed, and it doesn't need to be like that. So our heart, which is dry with all this, when the name of the Lord is chanted with love and devotion, it fills the heart with joy and with sweetness, and just remembering the Lord. The chanting should not be done mechanically. It should not be just Om Namah Shivaya, name of the Father and the Son, and not like that. But when it is done with feeling and with love and with the right emotion, then our heart is filled with beautiful flowers, filled with greenery, and the whole being then flourishes. So that is what he says, that the chanting of the name of the Lord in my mind is like the falling of the rain and the dry earth. And that's why he says that as you chant the name of the Lord, devotion grows. Devotion grows, love for the Lord grows. The more you remember him, the more you remember his beauty and his divine qualities and his love and his compassion and his concern for us. So that is what happens, that the Lord comes in our heart and devotion grows. We'll do the first verse, which is kind of short and which is connected with this topic. So I thought we'll do it together. Verse number 1 is on page 2. Namaste Rama Chandraya. Suhride Sarvadehinam. Sarvadehinam. Anugrahanishva Nishpatyaihi. Grahanishva Nishpatyaihi Sudha Bhakterhi Mam Prabho. Terhi Mam Prabho. So it says, Namaste, I bow down, I prostrate. That's why when we meet each other, we greet each other with Namaste. Bill always does that. Namah means I bow down. Te means to you. So when I say Namaste to somebody, that means I'm bowing to the Lord in you. Because the Lord is in you, so I bow down to you, and then you reciprocate by saying Namaste. That means I bow down to the Lord in you. So it is a mutual prostration to the Lord that is in each of our hearts. So here he says, Namaste Ramachandraya. So to Ramachandra, the Lord Rama, God who appeared on earth as a human, to him I prostrate. Why? Suhride Sarvadehinam. Suhride means he's a true friend. Sarvadehinam, to all beings. Not only to all humans, but he's a friend to all animals, birds, plants, fish. All beings are his friends. He loves them all. And he says, Anugrahanishva. Oh, please, Lord, bless me. Show me your compassion. Why? Sudha Bhakteirhi Nishpatyai. So I may develop this nectar of devotion, this love for you. That is the only thing I'm asking for. He's not praying to God, oh, give me a big house, or make sure my son gets a good job, or my daughter gets married, or, you know, or I have already 5 million, let me get another 2 million. Yeah, he's not asking for all that. May I get a bigger house? You know, I already have 5 bedrooms, but I, you know, need a 7-bedroom house on the golf course. He's not asking for all that. All he's asking for is, may I develop more love for you. That's all I want. Maybe I love you, but I don't think I love you enough. I want to love you more. Oh Lord, that is all I ask for. So they say, Suhride, Lord is a true friend. Most of our friendships are a kind of business. You know, why am I friendly with that person? You know why? Because he's a politician. You know, he has a lot of friends in Washington and he's well connected. And when I need my contract, you know, when I have to get a contract from the government, then he knows the congressman. And so he, through him, I can, you know, get my contract. Or this person, he's very successful and he's very well to do. And, you know, if I'm friends with him, he'll invite me to the parties. I hear he has very good parties in his house and a lot of liquor. And maybe I can, you know, get some. So, And even lot of our relationships are based on what I can get. And then if this person is no longer useful to me, you know, he lost in the election, then instantly we drop him. You know, then we pick who won, you know, who is the next one. So the Lord's friendship is not like a business. He loves us totally, unconditionally, completely. Even if we don't recognize him, even if we criticize him, even if we call him names, even if we never have time to think about him, he always thinks about us. He never lets us out of his sight, out of his mind. So that's why they say the Lord is the only true friend who will always be with you. Other friends may come and go. You know, friends may leave you, friends may move away. But the Lord can never move away because he is in our heart constantly as life. So that is the kind of friend. So he says, I prostrate to the Lord who is my true friend. And that is one of the beautiful relationships as we had talked last week. You can have different kind of relationships, but one of the most beautiful, I mean, there are many, all are beautiful, but having him as a friend, where he's my friend, he will always take care of me, he will never leave me. So that kind of a relationship one can develop. Of course, some people love God as a father, as an almighty creator. Some people love God as a child or even as a beloved. But here, Tulsidas Ji, the writer of this, Swami Tejomayananda, who we had introduced him last week, the author of this book says, this Lord is a true friend of all beings, not only me, but is a friend of all. So when I befriend anybody and I see the Lord in them, then I develop the oneness because the Lord in me is the same as the Lord in you. And then it says, what should we pray for? As we said, we should pray for devotion, and the prayer should not be selfish, should be for the benefit of all, should be for, made the whole universe benefit. That is the ideal prayer. Oh Lord, I pray for everybody in this universe. Whoever is suffering, may he or she, you know, get relieved of their suffering. May the Lord please help them. There's a very beautiful story I recently read. I'll end with that. So there is this western wall in Jerusalem where people go to pray, and it is kind of a little bit up on a hill, and so people go to pray for whatever they desire, and it is said that if you pray with enough devotion, a lot of times your desires are fulfilled. So there was this man who was approximately 80 years old, and every day he would climb up. And slowly, initially he had more energy, but as he got older, he would slowly, slowly with a cane, climb up, go to the wall, pray, and come back. And so this CNN journalist, she goes to interview him. And she happens to be covering the conflict. And so she goes, and so she says, sir, what is your name? So he says, my name is Morris Steinberg. You know, he was a Jew. And so she says, how old are you? He says, I'm 80 years old. So she said, I heard that you have been coming to this wall every day to pray. He says, yep, I've been coming for the past 60 years, every day, twice a day. I come in the morning, I come at night, I come in the morning, I come at night, twice a day for the past 60 years I have been praying. So she says, could I ask, what do you pray for? You know, I mean, I know you're not supposed to, but could you share with us? He says, yeah, I don't mind. He says, I have been praying that may there be peace between the Jews and the Muslims and between the Muslims and the Christians. And may, you know, there be end of wars and conflicts as we know it. And may our children grow up in an atmosphere that is free of hatred and anger and jealousy and competition. May there be more love. And then I'm praying that may our leaders who have been elected, may they work for our welfare, not for their selfish, you know, just for their selfish needs. So she asks him, so what? How does it feel after all these prayers? He says, I feel like I'm talking to a wall. So the point is, you may think that this person's prayer is a waste. You know, he has been praying for 60 years. There's still violence. There's still, you know, conflicts. There's leaders are still corrupt. No prayer goes wasted, because when you send out a prayer into the cosmos, into the universe where the Lord is, even though you may not see the end complete result, but it definitely has an impact. First of all, it has an impact on your mind. The moment you remember the Lord with love, devotion, gratitude, instantly your mind becomes pure. Your mind becomes peaceful. Whether the other person's benefits or not, if I remember God and just chant his name with love, instantly my mind becomes quiet. It becomes peaceful. That is why. And the second thing is that just as if you send out negative waves into the cosmos of anger and hatred, I hate this person, and why is this person like that? So you are spreading negative vibrations. So similarly, when you send out vibrations of love and compassion and kindness, eventually it does. And if enough people in the world, in fact, there are people who meditate, they say that if enough people start meditating and spreading this vibration of love, the world will become a better place. And in that book, they talk in that book called Spiritual Understanding, it says it very beautifully that there is an awakening in the world. An awakening is happening, even though we say, I don't see it. I see so much conflict and so much jealousy and so much killing and all. But the human being has reached the depth of its depravity right now. And all the thinkers are predicting that a new world is awakening from that, from the ruins of that old world. And whether we like it or not, there is going to be an awakening in the world. And if you want to be part of it, you can if you just participate in that. Make your heart more positive and more loving and sharing and giving. The less selfishness, the less negativity you have, the more you will be in touch with that awakening, with that new growth of that new universe that is happening. So in our scriptures, they talk about the four yugas, you know, Satyug, Dwapar, Treta, and then Kaliyug, the lowest, the worst one. And after the worst comes the best. Then the Satyug starts again. They're already predicting that. So this new awakening has started, and that is what happens when you pray. And if enough people are praying, if enough people are meditating, if enough people are spreading, again, the prayer should be unselfish, should be for the benefit of all. Because the Lord Almighty already knows what I need. I don't have to tell him, oh Lord, may my son get a job, or may I be freed of this illness, or you know, my daughter is having problems with her husband, may that be relieved. Yeah, you can. I mean, you know, if you're going to ask anybody, you may as well ask the Lord. There's nothing wrong with that. But he already knows that the better is to pray just for the welfare of all, including my family, including my children. So I should not limit my prayers. So that is what we should pray for. And that Steinberg's prayers will never go wasted, no matter he's, you know, talking to a wall. But that act of praying itself has a lot of power in it. So this is just a little introduction to the beginning, and the next week we shall go more into the what are the benefits of prayer and devotion and what is all that. So we shall be talking about that. Any questions? Any comments?
In the world, and hoping that he knows really what I want too.
No, no.
And I know it's inside, but I'm just saying.
Right. Because they say he knows your thoughts even before they have become thoughts. You know, in our scriptures, they talk about pre-thought and pre-pre-thought. Even before, from this vasana, from this desire, even before the thought has arisen that I need to ask for that, he already knows what you are going to ask for. So, but it's okay. You know, you can talk to him and say, oh God, give me this. There's nothing wrong with that. But more is, give me love, so I may love you, and I may know you, and I may reach you, and I may become one with you. That is the highest prayer. That is the only thing we should pray for, is make me part of you, and may I never forget you, may I never separate you. In fact, there is a very beautiful song in Hindi, and it's a very beautiful bhajan. He says, Sambhav hai jhanjaton mein main tujhko bhool jaun, par Nath, tum mujhe kabhi na bula dena. He says, maybe I may get so busy. I may be so busy in my work. I don't have time to think about you. This lady is praying. You know, I have family responsibilities and husband and children and their house and all. But you don't forget me. You make sure I never, you know, you stay in my heart always and keep reminding me of your presence. So the idea being that even though no matter how busy I am in my work, may I never forget you. May I always have time to think about you. And if you can do proper prayer in the morning, it's good. 5, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, you sit down and, you know, light a candle or do an aarti or do some prayer. But the rest of the day, one should make every effort to remember the Lord of my heart. And it should be done throughout the day as often as you can. No matter how busy you are, it's never, you're never too busy to remember him. It shouldn't be, at least. Yeah, that's a very good point. In fact, even in Islam, they sacrifice a goat. You know, at the, there is a festival called Bakri Eid where they actually chop off the head of the goat and offer it to the Lord. But there was a great thinker in India who interpreted this differently. He says, when you're sacrificing a goat, now when a goat or a sheep, it says meh, meh, right? Meh, meh. That's what a sheep says when it is speaking. So in Hindi, meh means I. Meh means I, the ego. So when it says sacrifice the goat, it's not the animal goat, but the goat that says meh, that says I, that I has to be sacrificed. That me, you know, I, me, that is the only sacrifice he really wants. I know the scriptures say it and I don't want to contradict them, but in my opinion, the only thing you have, see, everything else that you sacrifice belongs to the Lord, right? You say, I offer a flower. I pick a flower from my garden and I go and offer it to the Lord. Okay, Lord, I offer you this flower. In Hinduism, we do that. Now, who grew that flower? Did you grow it? You say, oh, I planted it, I put the... But who actually, you know, from the seed caused the flower to bloom and to grow? You didn't. It was from the Lord's garden. You took the flower from his garden and then you go and offer it to him. It's like somebody comes to my house and drives off with my car and then says, you know what, I'm going to give you a gift. And then he comes and gives me my car back and says, I've given you, he'll say, what? It's my car. You took it from me and now you're giving it back to me as a gift. What kind of gift? But that is what we do. Anything that we offer to the Lord, if you cook food, okay, I cooked food for the Lord. But the grains from which you made the food and all the vegetables and all the everything that you used to cook, you got from his garden. He grew them. You just collected them, made them into a food, and you, it's good. You do it with, I'm not saying you shouldn't offer a flower or you shouldn't offer, you know, food to the Lord. You should offer before you eat. And that is all very good. But the highest sacrifice is the sacrifice of man, that I, that ego. That is the only thing that belongs to us. Everything else belongs to the Lord. Only thing I possess is my little stupid ego. And that is the only thing you need to sacrifice. So when we say sacrifice, we're not saying kill an animal. That's very inhumane. I think that's because the Lord has created this beautiful animal. And when you chop off his neck to offer it, I don't think the Lord would be pleased. That's my humble opinion. I know the scriptures say that. Islam says it. Christianity says it. Even some of the Hindu beliefs, they also believe in sacrificing an animal for the mother goddess. But in my opinion, that all-kind, merciful God would not be happy if one of his animals was slaughtered in his name. So to me, I mean, you know, not only slaughtering, but I know I'm in the wrong place, but even eating animals is also part of that same thing. Because you may not be killing the animal, but somebody is slaughtering this innocent sheep or lamb or this chicken or this cow somewhere. You see, when you drive on I-5, also you see these thousands of cows, you know, that are kept on. And they're all going to be slaughtered so somebody can have, you know, the double, what is it, Big Mac in hamburgers, Wendy's cheeseburger. So even that is also, you are as much a part of that killing as the person who actually operated the chainsaw which cut that animal's neck. So truly, you know, I mean, again, I'm not trying to preach or not trying to propagate my opinions, but really, killing of animals is not, because they have life, they cry, they, you know, they bleed and they scream, and, you know, and I'm sure they are not happy as they have been dragged, you know, to that slaughter, and you know, they're, so it can't be a pleasant feeling for them, or, you know, I don't know. So that's not sacrifice, in my opinion, in my humble opinion. I know that I'm contradicting all the scriptures, but to me, the only sacrifice worth doing is sacrifice your ego. That's the only thing belongs to you. Even this body doesn't belong to you. When he said sacrifice yourself, what he means is give up that ego, that I and my, because nothing belongs to me. This whole universe, this house that I consider mine, I didn't create the stones and the bricks and the wood and the steel that went into it. Everything was created from the Lord. I just paid a contractor to collect it and put it together. Even the money I earned, the abilities I had were all given by him. So nothing belongs to me. My children don't belong to me. My spouse doesn't belong to me. My house, my money, everything is his. Only thing belongs to me is the little ego. So that's the only thing you can give up. Only thing you can sacrifice. Only thing you should sacrifice. Of course, if you go to a temple and take some flowers or take some fruits or light a candle as a gesture of my love for you, that is good. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying that one shouldn't do that. But one should not have the arrogance that I am such a great donor. I have done so much for the community. I give so much. Oh Lord, you are the one who has given me everything, and if a part of that is used in taking care of your beings, that is just my humble, return, a little humble gift back of what I have. So I think that is sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Sacrifice that I, that man. That is the true Bakri Eid. That is the true killing of the goat. Is that goat that says meh, 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 that says I. Thank you. That's a very nice question. It's beautiful.